We notice that chapter 7 says, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. I had a very interesting question given me at the end of the hour last time in writing, asking, does this mean that Daniel saw real things? Or does it mean that God caused pictures to appear before him? Or that he had a dream and there were pictures in his head? Well, how God gave it to him, we really don't know. You might say that everything we see is pictures in our head. Did you ever think of the fact that you get light in through the right eye and light through the left eye, but you don't see two pictures, you see one? And they tell us that actually everything from the right side of both eyes goes to the left side of the brain, and everything from the left side of both eyes goes to the right side of the brain. And how are those four things put together to be one picture? We don't know. But we see one picture, and God caused Daniel to see one picture. Maybe it was simply a dream. Maybe he was still conscious, but God caused him to see things, but he knew it was a vision. He knew it was not things that were actually happening then, but things God caused him to see. And these things sometimes might be representations in actual picture of something that's going to happen in the future, but more often they are symbolic. They are represent, like in the statue Nebuchadnezzar saw, and in the four beasts he saw, they are symbols. Well, the chapter 7 starts in the first year of Belshazzar. Daniel had a dream. And then we read about the dream and the interpretation mixed in with it. Chapter 8 begins in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar. A vision appeared unto me, even unto Daniel, after that which appeared to me before. So here we have a new vision, a new experience 2 years later. So that division is in a very good place. And then chapter 9, in the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, of the seed of the Medes, who was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood by books, so and so. And he goes on and tells what happened at a later time than chapter 8. He tells of his prayer and of God's answer to the prayer. And then chapter 10 begins, in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a thing was revealed to Daniel, whose name was called Belteshazzar. And so all four of these chapters start with a new time given at which Daniel either received a new message from God or made a prayer as a result of which he received a message from God. There were several who made a division which put 9 to 11 together as one unit. Well, the beginning of 10 is a clear break. Just as clear a break as at the beginning of 9 and at the beginning of 8. So I was sorry to see anyone make the division that way. And then at chapter 10, we have how Daniel prays, and the Lord says he will send him an answer. And he sends an angel who says, now I will tell you the truth. Behold, there will yet stand up 3 kings of Persia, and the 4th shall be far richer than they. And then it goes right on with God's message to him through chapter 11 and through at least part of chapter 12. So if you want to say 10 to 12 is one unit as compared to the 3 previous units, that is a good division, even though it makes your last one much longer than the others. Now in chapter 12, I believe there should be a break, that there are a few verses that are separate from the rest. But that you would have to really study the chapter carefully to find where that will be. And we're not to that as yet. However, I was quite disappointed to find a few, not a great many, who began a new vision with chapter 11, verse 1. And, of course, you're not much worse than the archbishop is, who made the chapter division there. But after all, he was probably riding on horseback, and so there's an excuse for his not seeing it very clearly. But you notice how different it is. Chapter 10, in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a thing was revealed to Daniel. Chapter 11, also I, in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I stood to confirm and strengthen him. That's not an introduction to a vision. That's a continuation of what has been said by the messenger before that, who is now introducing his message. And so if you want to make a break at 11:2, having the prayer and the coming of the messenger, and then a break between that and what the messenger says, that is all right. But to make one at 11:1, as they say, the archbishop is excusable. I won't mark him down for it. Well, now we want to look at all of these chapters, but we want to go further in our examination of chapter 7 first, and so we will turn back to it now. And in chapter 7, we began with number 3, the prophecy in Daniel 7, the setting of the prophecy. We noticed, and this is important, that is at least 45 years after Daniel 2. And we don't know exactly how long, because we don't know when Belshazzar was associated with his father as co-king. And then second, we noted, what is true of all the succeeding chapters, that the vision was given to Daniel himself. That is true of the entire last part of last half of Daniel. Number 3, we've already noted that the interpretation was included in the vision here. And that is true in the rest of the book too, in contrast to chapter 2, in which Daniel had Nebuchadnezzar had the vision, and Daniel gave him the interpretation. Number 4, part of the vision is retold with added detail. I think you've all noticed that. I may have mentioned it once or twice already. A peculiar feature of chapter 7, not paralleled anywhere else in the book. And then number 5, symbolism and plain language not so sharply separated as in chapter 2. That we've already discussed to some extent. Then B, though the symbolism is entirely different, there are 4 obvious parallels to chapter 2. And the first of these is that there are 4 kingdoms presented. Now, in chapter 2, we had 5 parts to the image. And the question we could not give an answer to from chapter 2 alone. Are there 5 kingdoms or 4? But there was a possibility that there were 4 intended, because iron was in both of the last 2 parts. So that was a definite possibility in 2, but you cannot say positively from 2 alone. But when you get to chapter 7, you find that there are 4 beasts. And you find that the 4th beast has additional things said about it that would be later than the time when it began. And so we learn from chapter 7, we are justified in carrying this back to chapter 2, that chapter 2 has 4 kingdoms and not 5. I say we're justified in carrying it back because it is not introducing a new thing into chapter 2, but it is deciding which of 2 possibilities is the correct one. And chapter 7 gives us the answer on that. Number 2, the parallel that the 4th is to have a second phase. So that is a marked similarity. Number 3, the complete destruction of the kingdoms. In chapter 2, the statue is so completely destroyed that no slightest trace of it remains. In chapter 7, the 4th beast is burnt. His body is given to the fire. He is completely destroyed. This complete destruction of these kingdoms, not a taking over of their qualities into any new kingdom. And number 4, there is a new universal regime in both of them. So we have these marked similarities between chapters 2 and 7, which justify us in saying these two are giving a picture of the same thing. A foreview of certain important events in history running for a long period after the time of Daniel, and a foreview in which certain features are suggested in chapter 2, a few things told about them, but added matters are told in chapter 7. And so, capital C, we look at the 4 kingdoms. Now, I don't know whether you have noted this next point. As in chapter 2, there is no specific prediction of the overthrow of any of the first 3 kingdoms. That is to say, the whole statue is destroyed. But what happened was that the Babylonian kingdom was conquered by the Persians and taken over, and the Persian kingdom conquered by Alexander the Great and taken over. And the different parts of Alexander the Great's kingdom were conquered by the Romans and taken over. But the scripture merely says, after you there will be another king, and after it a third, which shall rule over the whole earth. And so the first three kingdoms, there is no specific prediction in either chapter of an overthrow of any one of them. Now this is something which someone might immediately question, and I myself would have questioned it not very long ago. Because you notice that in chapter 7, it speaks about the first kingdom in a way which at first sight might seem to tell of its destruction. Chapter 7, verse 4, "The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I beheld till its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth and made stand upon its feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it." Now, at first sight, you can say, here's the first kingdom described, and it's lifted up from the earth, it is destroyed. But it is no way to say something was destroyed. To say it's made to stand on its feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it, that's no account of destruction. And certainly, the conquest of the Babylonian kingdom by the Persians couldn't be called a man's heart being given to it. It is quite obvious when you look closely at it that this verse describes something quite different from that. And so I've made that number two here. The added detail about the first kingdom, verse 4. And the what it means is shown in Daniel 4. Because in the fourth chapter of Daniel, we have the account of how God told, had Daniel tell Nebuchadnezzar, that Nebuchadnezzar was going to go out of his mind, that he was going to grovel on the ground, that he was going to live like an animal. And then he was told that after a certain length of time, that God would raise him up again from this condition and again give him a man's heart and return his kingdom to him. And so this is a description of what happened to Nebuchadnezzar, not to the Babylonian kingdom. And that fits, of course, with the way that the first part of the statue was introduced in chapter 2, where it said, "O king, thou art the head of gold." This describes something that had happened to Nebuchadnezzar at least 10 years, maybe 20 years before Daniel had this vision. And so here, he is giving him a statement about the first kingdom, which shows to him clearly that the first kingdom is the same as the head of the statue, that it is Nebuchadnezzar, and which shows him something that has already happened, and therefore strengthens his faith that what follows in chapter 7 is also going to happen. So here, a part of the description is not a prophecy, but a picture of what has already happened. And then we notice number 3 about the second kingdom. And the second kingdom is in verse 5, where he says, "Behold, another beast, a second like a bear, and it raised itself up on one side." And many think that this statement, "it raised itself up on one side," suggests the fact that the second kingdom was the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians, in which the Persians had been subordinate to the Medes, but in which they gained superiority over the Medes before the time that they conquered the Babylonians. It raised itself up on one side. Others say, well, that's just a description of the way a bear walks, with one side sort of lifted up. Well, I haven't seen enough bears walking to make a judgment between those two interpretations. Whether it at any rate, that was true of the second kingdom. Does this here give a picture of that fact about it or not? I don't think we can say for certain, but it is at least a possibility. But then it says that it had three ribs in the mouth of it between its teeth, and they said, "Arise, devour much flesh." And this is a good picture of what Cyrus did, because Cyrus rose in his kingdom and gained supremacy over all the Medes, and then he led his army westward and conquered the region north of Babylonia, and then north and conquered all of Asia Minor, and then he led it back and down south again and conquered Babylonia. And then again he went east and conquered further, going right to the very borders of India. And so this "arise, devour much flesh" is a picture of the conquest of Cyrus going way beyond the territory held by the Babylonians. But it says there were three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And many commentators will tell you what these three ribs represent. Now here, I have a footnote here. It says, that is Lydia, Babylonia, Egypt, ETC. And the important word in that note is ETC. He conquered many areas. And I don't think we have a right to pick three and say these are the most important of them. We can't, because he conquered so many areas, including several of very great importance. I think we can say here the three ribs is simply that a vivid picture of the fact that he was conquering nations and absorbing them into his kingdom, and that the number three here is just that it was not just the conquest of the Babylonian Empire, it was the conquest of more. But the attempt to precisely say what these three refer to, we have no clear evidence in history to pick out three, and I think we're justified in saying it just means a number, that he conquered a lot. So I don't think there's any special significance here to the number three. And then we look at what we're told about the fourth kingdom. And we read about the fourth kingdom in verse 6. And after this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a fowl. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. Now I don't think the number four in four wings of a fowl has any particular specific importance. But I think that it is true that you'd never expect a leopard to have wings. And to say it has four wings stresses the fact of great mobility. And the kingdom of Alexander was the conquest which they made so rapidly can hardly be paralleled in history until you get to Napoleon and Hitler with the blitzkrieg that each of these men carried out. Cyrus was a tremendous conqueror and conquered many areas, but it was hard to parallel it, but it was a steady, constant conquest over a series of years. While Alexander, during a short reign of only 12 years, conquered the greatest empire the world had ever seen up to that time. It was marked by its tremendous rapidity. And so the four wings shows its tremendous movement. I think we are justified in taking that from that, but not in giving any particular attention to the fact that we're four wings rather than three or five. But then the beast also had four heads, and that's a queer thing, that one beast would have more than one head. The beast had four heads. And I believe we are justified in saying there is a suggestion there 200 years in advance of the fact that Alexander's empire would not remain united very long. It had one great head, Alexander, whose genius conquered all these areas, and to whom all his soldiers were devoted, and who controlled definitely everything that was done during the 12 years of his reign. But after his death, his generals couldn't decide who should succeed him, and they tried to make one nominally succeed him, but the others would not submit to him. And after a period of disagreement and dissension, they fought with each other for 40 years and finally ended up with dividing it up into various sections, each independent of the other. And yet we can think of them still as being one empire, because Greek culture was made predominant in all of them. And there was a similarity of outlook and attitude in all of these kingdoms into which Alexander's empire was divided. So when we say it has four heads, it is predicting something that people 200 years after Daniel's time could look at and say, yes, that corresponds to what actually happened. And that would give them increased faith that what else was said would also come to pass. Then we come to the fourth kingdom, verses 7 and 19. And we have a number of things told us about the fourth kingdom. That is what Daniel 2 and Daniel 7 are really leading up to. We find in these verses that it is strong and destructive. We find that was suggested in Daniel 2 by the fact that it was of iron, and like iron that crushes, it would crush. Here we are told that it has iron claws, and it has, or part of it is iron, part of it is bronze. It is strong and destructive. It is not named. It is simply a beast, very great and very terrible. So we find it is different from its predecessor. Now, I don't think it was different from them in being more terrible, actually. I don't think it was different in being more brutal. I don't think it was different in being more determined to take a great oversight over every one of its citizens. But it was when it was thwarted, it became very brutal. When there were uprisings against it, it was very brutal. Or when someone refused to submit to it. How then was the Roman Empire different from the preceding? Actually, the ways in which it was would hardly be suggested by the brief statements here. But it was very different in three ways. First, there was an entirely different kind of organization, and that's one of the reasons why the Roman Empire lasted longer than any two of the others put together, almost as long as the three put together. Because the preceding ones were dependent on hereditary control, and the power went from father to son, and sometimes a son inherits his father's abilities and strength, but very often he doesn't. And through history, the hereditary type of control has not been very satisfactory. And in the case of the Romans, through a long period in which of democracy, actually, in which for many years the Roman people had decided what would happen in their realm, until they finally got into such a rather chaotic condition that some individuals with great strength were able to seize control. But even then, they had these types of organizations so established that it gave a continuing strength to it that lasted after that for four more centuries, when it had a man whom they called an emperor. But comparatively seldom were there as many as three men in a row who went from father to son. And in great many cases in the Roman Empire, when an emperor tried to have his son succeed him, it was found to be a failure. Perhaps the best government that any part of the world has ever had in its history was the government of the Roman Empire in the 2nd century A.D., a government which perhaps had more justice for its citizens, more general equality and opportunity and freedom and general safety than almost any period in history. Was the 2nd century A.D. And what made the 2nd century such a wonderful period was that each emperor during that period carefully studied to pick the man who would be most fitted to carry on as he did and adopted him. And then he became his successor. So there is, until you get to the end of the century, there is no going from father to son. But neither did its leaders come into power because they could speak well over TV, could make a good impression with their personality, but because a careful study was made of their qualities and abilities, and they were selected for that. And toward the end of the 2nd century, Marcus Aurelius, very foolishly,
made his own son succeed him, and he proved to be one of the worst emperors Rome ever had, and it broke this succession. But even so, even though this was broken, and for the next century, the Roman emperors were selected generally by the army, and there was an average of 4 years that one of them would last before he was killed and another one put in. Yet, the general strength of the empire was such that it lasted in full strength for another 2 centuries after the end of that wonderful period of the 2nd century AD. So a different kind of organization, altogether different from that of the 3 preceding rulerships. No hereditary monarchy. That might be considered part of the first, but it's so important I listed separately. And, of course, as a result of these, it lasted far longer than the others. The Roman Senate theoretically had the power over the conquered nations. And the emperor always said the Roman Senate has decreed and so on. It was a system which had great strength in it. And at this time when the Roman Catholic Church is endeavoring to find a new head, we can notice that part of that feature is continued. There has been only one time I know of when a pope has tried to get his son made pope succeeding him. And since according to the law, the pope isn't supposed to have a son, he did not succeed in accomplishing that. But there is a marvelous organization in the Roman Catholic Church in that the pope can appoint cardinals, but he can't say what those cardinals are going to do after he dies. And various popes have tried to dictate who would be his successor, and rarely, if ever, has one succeeded. And so you have a group of men who have been selected by the previous pope or by previous popes and who have to make a decision among themselves instead of having a great number of people decide, which is apt to be on the basis of who makes the best personal impression and so on. And so it is a type of organization which is one of the main reasons why that organization has lasted so long. And perhaps another reason why we might be able to think of the Roman Empire to some extent as continuing all through this period. It was not conquered like the 3 previous ones were and taken over by another one, but instead it disintegrated, and various features of it have continued in the many little sovereignties that have taken its place through the years since. Whether we should think of it as continuing through this period, or whether we should think that the empire having actually come to an end, that the second phase must be something that is still future with an unmentioned interval between, I don't think we can be dogmatic at this point, but we can say there is this long perspective that the prophet had. Now, D, the second phase of the fourth kingdom, and here there's a very interesting thing. Number one, there is no obvious similarity to the fifth part of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. If you just had the account of the fifth part of the statue, and you just had what is told you about what happened to this beast, how it got 10 horns, and then how one came up and 3 disappeared in front of it, and then how it had a voice that spoke great boasts, and how it tried to change times and seasons and so on, why, nobody would think that that was represented the same thing as the feet and toes being made of iron and clay together. It is very, very different from the account of the second phase there. But since we have so many similarities between the two, we are justified in saying that these 2 utterly different pictures of the second phase of the fourth kingdom are referring to events or situations that take place in the same time period, and therefore to putting them together. And then in this second phase, we find something of which we had really no hint in the statue, that there will be 10 new kings. Well, now, we have in the interpretation here, in verse 17, one who stood by said to Daniel, these great beasts which are 4 are 4 kings. The beasts are 4, and yet it says that the 10 horns on the 4th beast are 4. And so we notice that the word king and kingdom are used rather indiscriminately. in these chapters. Sometimes they are used to represent, as it does here, a whole long period of two or three or more centuries, spoken of as a king or as a kingdom. And sometimes they're used for individual kings. And so when he said to Nebuchadnezzar, "Thou art this head of gold," we are left with the question, is Nebuchadnezzar the head of gold, or is the Neo-Babylonian Empire the head, or is it the whole period of Assyro-Babylonian supremacy, which latter I think is most likely, but I wouldn't be dogmatic about it. Well, then we have this these 10 new kings, and immediately you ask, we are simply told there were 10 horns. This beast had 10 horns. Now, do these 10 horns represent 10 kings who reigned at the same time? Or do they represent 10 kings who came one after the other? We have no way to prove from the statements here in chapter 7. Either is a possibility of interpretation here, whether they are simultaneous or whether they are successive. We find that a little horn came up, and before it, three of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. And that seems to suggest that this represents 10 kings who were reigning at one time in different areas, and that a new one came up and got control of three of them. It suggests that. On the other hand, those who hold the critical theory say that Antiochus Epiphanes, that before him, his father, who had been ruling before him, that his father had died, and his brother, who ruled just before him, had been murdered, and the brother's son, who should logically have succeeded him, he got in ahead of him and seized the power, and so they say that three kings disappeared before him. Well, I do not think the critical interpretation is correct, but I can say that on this particular idea that it might be three successive kings rather than three simultaneous kings, that they're necessarily wrong in that particular feature. We cannot draw a great deal more from this passage. We have the two possibilities. Then, number three is the rise of the little horn. And we find the little horn discussed in verses 8 and 11 and 20. And you, of course, have looked at these in connection with your study of the chapter. You have noticed that verse 8 and verse 24 tell about the growing power of this little horn. This little horn came up and became bigger than the others, stronger than the others. Three disappeared before. We find its arrogance in verse 25. "He shall speak great words against the Most High." This is part of the interpretation. It in the picture, it said he had eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking great things. "He shall speak great words against the Most High and shall wear out the saints of the Most High and think to change the times and the seasons." It wasn't so many years ago when some were suggesting this was fulfilled in Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who tried to change the date of Thanksgiving, but he didn't succeed. Since that time, we've had Congress changing the dates of a number of our holidays, and so, but I don't think it describes Congress here. But it describes what the arrogance of this one. Its attempt to make great changes. Some have thought this could be found fulfilled in Julius Caesar, because Julius Caesar changed the times and seasons. He introduced a new calendar, which we have used ever since, except for a slight modification made 200 years ago. But I certainly don't think it's speaking about Julius Caesar. Then we have this specific feature that he makes war against the saints. Verse 21, "I beheld in the same horn made war against the saints and prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High." Very different from the idea that is coming to be widely taught now in certain circles, that the church is going to gradually reach more and more people with the gospel until the whole world is going to be converted, and this is to happen before the return of Christ. It doesn't fit at all with what is said here, that he made war against the saints and prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High. They didn't seize the judgment.
They weren't able to take it by power. It was given to them. And we notice in connection with that, it's apparent victory, verses 21 and 25. He prevailed against them. And then number four under this second part, we notice the destruction of the fourth kingdom. Verses 11 and verse 26. I beheld then, because of the voice of the great words which the horn spoke, I beheld even till the beast was slain and his body destroyed. It doesn't say the horn was destroyed. It says the beast was destroyed. It's like in chapter 2, where it doesn't say that the feet and toes were destroyed. It says the whole statue was destroyed. So it's completely destroyed, the entire fourth kingdom. But here there's a very interesting little feature, verse 12. Verse 12 I was puzzled by when I first studied. As for the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. And nothing is told us here of the destruction of the other three. But we are told in chapter 2 that the whole statue was destroyed. And so I feel that when it says their lives were prolonged for a season and time, it means they were prolonged until the fourth beast was destroyed. But then they're all destroyed, which means, of course, not that certain individuals are destroyed, but that all the principles that enter into the type of human government represented by Nebuchadnezzar, represented by Persian and by the Greek leaders, that type of human government, all of its features are going to be completely destroyed. But it doesn't specifically say that about the other three, but it does say they had their dominion taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. And that makes clear that the four together are one statue. That the qualities of the Babylonian kingdom were many of them taken over by the Persian, and the qualities of the Persian were many of them taken over by the Greek, and the qualities of the Greek were many of them taken over by the Roman Empire. Their lives were prolonged for a season and time, but the whole thing is to be completely destroyed at the time when the beast is killed and its body is given to the flames. And then we have a capital E, the vision of deity, verses 9 to 10. And now this is still in the dream, still in the vision which he has. And in the King James Version, the first verse of it is, I think, gives us a very wrong impression at first. I beheld till the thrones were cast down. The Aramaic word there normally means to place or put. It's used in Ezra where the king says they shall not place impost or taxes upon these people. It means that he looked and he saw coming into his vision, he saw thrones. And it might suggest that it fit with the destruction described in verse 8. But there's no destruction until you get to verse 11. And so this is simply as he looked, he saw come into view before him thrones. And how many people sat? Just says one did. The Ancient of Days sat. And yet there were thrones there. And that, of course, has caused many people great curiosity. Why are there thrones when only one sits? It is a peculiar thing. And some say he was merely the presiding officer, like a judge who sees that the various attorneys are fair in what they do. He has the 12 jurors up here and they make the decisions. But I don't think that's what the picture sounds like at all. It sounds to me like a picture of the great omnipotent God rather than the picture of the presiding officer of the court trial. And the fact that it has the plural thrones, we, with our understanding from the New Testament, can think of perhaps a suggestion of the fact of the Trinity, but I think that's perhaps reading back too much into this. Perhaps we think of the greatness of the deity that it uses the word throne in the plural, but there certainly is no suggestion here that there was any other powerful one sharing power with the one pictured here. That's why I call it a vision of deity. I don't think it's a picture of a court case. And that's why I'm rather disturbed that practically all recent translations translate the end of verse 10. The court sat and the books were opened. And that sounds as if he was the presiding judge and others sat with him to make decisions. I don't think that's the picture you have here at all. I think you have a picture here of the powerful God, the great, pure one, the one with absolute authority, who looks down upon earth and sees the little horn ranting against him and trying to change times and seasons and establish things the way he wants them on earth. And in contrast, he sees something that illustrates the great power and majesty of God. Certainly, he did not see God. God is a spirit. God does not have a body. He did not see God, but he saw a representation which symbolized the power and greatness and eternity of God. The Ancient of Days sat, his garment was white as snow, the hair of his head was pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame. The King James has the word like in italics, which is not in the original. His throne was a fiery flame. The wheels of the throne were burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. 1,000 thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. Well, do these 10,000 times 10,000, are they the members of the court that are going to make a decision? It's quite obvious. You don't have to have a judgment with a decision to decide what to do with the beast. It's pictured very clearly. His wickedness, his arrogance, his brutality. And here we have, in contrast to the vain boasts of the beast, we have the great power of the great God and his authority and the tremendous number of his representatives ready to do his bidding. And so when it says the judgment was set, the word here translated judgment is not a concrete word. And most of those who take this as a court say that the word for decision or judgment is here used abstract for concrete. It means the court. But the word, it seems to me the King James represents the thought of the whole situation much better. God's judgment was set. It was determined. It continued. It still sat there. The beast with his arrogance, the little horn with his declarations and his attempt to destroy all that God desired, could not succeed because God's judgment has been set from all eternity. It is not a judgment seat, a scene, in my opinion, in the sense of a court, of making decisions. But it is God as the one who carries out the decisions that he has made long before. And said, the books are opened, I would then take as being a symbolic representation of God's omniscience, of the fact that he knows everything and he acts wisely in all that he does. I would not take it as these various ones with him trying to explain to him just what is happening and all that. It seems to me that that is what we have here in this picture. Now, number 7, the Son of Man. And here in a picture which is symbolic, we have something happening which, as far as this passage is concerned, could be symbolic. But I believe we have, in the midst of the symbols, we have a literal thing. That is to say, he saw something. He saw all these things, of course, but he saw this thing which was not meant as a symbol, but as a picture in advance of something that was going to happen. And I don't think we could say that dogmatically apart from the New Testament evidence, but I think the New Testament evidence makes that clear. He saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man. Now, this word Son of Man is used in Daniel 8:17, where God's messenger says to Daniel, "Understand, O Son of Man." Son of Man just means any man, one of the class of man. But here he saw one who looked like a man. But this picture here came to be recognized by the Jews as a picture of the coming of the Messiah. And Jesus Christ used the term for himself, the Son of Man, clearly referring back to this usage, not to the usage, of course, in chapter 8, where it just means a man, not to Ezekiel, where hundreds of times, or dozens of times, rather,
Ezekiel is addressed as Son of Man. But it is this one picture which shows the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven. And here we have one coming who has great authority. Now, whether you would say that he saw one who would be coming with the clouds of heaven, who came to the Ancient of Days and was given authority prior to his coming, or whether you say he saw him coming and he realized what had already happened, that he had been brought before the Ancient of Days and given dominion, glory, and kingdom that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. Whichever way you take it, I believe the usages in the New Testament shows, and also the Psalm 110:1 show, that the giving of authority to him precedes his coming with the clouds of heaven. And that this is a literal picture of one coming in the clouds of heaven, as shown by the New Testament references. But that, of course, it is symbolic, his coming to the, being brought before the Ancient of Days, and that is symbolic because the Ancient of Days is a spirit. It wouldn't be a physical thing. But it is exactly what is described in Psalm 110:1, that the Lord said to him, "Sit thou at my right hand until I make thine enemies thy footstool." Now, we discussed this Son of Man a bit already, and there's only a little more we need to look at in this chapter. And so I think this would be a good place to make a break. We'll have a little more to say about the chapter.